Session number 7304, room 7.
Colonel King, Real 7. I think you were describing the effects of heat on the march from Mercer Tacli.
Yes, I say the first company, which was 8 Company, started off about 5 o'clock in the morning. Slightly later than was intended, but to my mind, about 5. The distance to march, I'm not sure, but it was rather a long way, actually. It was between 18 and 28 miles, I think. It may have been 30 miles. I can't remember. They were in a sort of, as I say, not tactical, but they were going platoon by platoon, as opposed to a whole company on a route march. I don't think there was any reason to suppose any enemy we were going to meet, or could have been, because the carriers had been on ahead. And I know Major Phelps had gone on ahead there himself along that track in a vehicle. And nobody bumped the back of him in trouble or anything like that. Anyway, you can imagine, with the temperature there is on that Red Sea coast, because Massal is facing, it's one of the hottest places on Earth. And it's very humid as well, because one's so close to sea. So, and we're not very far from Massal. And we were marching along this track. A lot of it was very soft sand in places. A lot of it was crossing the track, a so-called track crossing wadis with soft sand in the bottom. Sometimes rocky, sometimes soft. But anyways, it was very, very hot. After about, I suppose, 3 hours marching, I regret to say that a lot of soldiers were falling out. And it's the old, old trouble that once soldiers start falling out, it catches on. And the next thing that happened, which is unfortunate, was that the vehicles of my company and A Company and other vehicles behind us coming up from Mercer Tacli along the line of the track started picking up soldiers that had fallen out. Soon as that happened, again, that was about the worst thing that could happen, these particular vehicles. Because as they went up the track, passing other people ahead who were still on their feet, the natural reaction of the soldier was, why the bloody hell should I march in this god-awful heat when other bloody people are getting lifts on vehicles? So they start falling out. And in the end, a lot of soldiers fell out because of that. But a lot of the ones who did fall out as well, who wanted to keep going, fell out from genuine heat exhaustion. The march was too long, it was wrongly timed. In the end, a very large proportion of my company fell out. I made it, my sergeant major made it, my signaller, my orderly, my batman rather, he made it, and quite a few others. But some of the people in the front, in the forward platoons of mine now, they had fallen by the wayside, and so had the platoon of the platoon behind. I was due to get in to the position where we were stopping the night at about, I suppose, 1 o'clock. Maybe a little earlier. We didn't get in till about 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock that afternoon, because of the latter part of the march, one was having to stop for 10 minutes every 20 minutes. And that was the story of that march. Thereafter, a very good lesson was learnt. Thereafter, when we joined up the battalion, and the battalion was marched, and we marched for days and days and days and days through Eritrea to get down towards Kerin. with the fighting the odd action at Cub Cub and places like that, one started off at night, and the first company had moved off by midnight or even before. So the last company never was away later than about 3 o'clock in the morning. And then you marched until you hoped to get in by about 9 o'clock in the morning there, at the latest or earlier, and then you were fed and breakfasted and rested.
What was the temperature like at night when you were marching?
The temperature? In the from the Mersetek light towards Elgena was up in the hills, so it was now very pleasant by night. Temperature very pleasant. Down on the coast, Mersetek light, it got cooler at night. That's all you can say.
But not much.
No, it was a very, very. It was very humid indeed. Very humid indeed.
Were there any measures you could take to counteract the effects of heat exhaustion and dehydration?
Well, on the march, no, none. None. Every man had his water bottle, and there was it. The water, such water trucks that had gone on, the battalion water trucks that had gone on ahead to fill up and be at the next place where you stopped. So the men could refill their water bottles. Tea and things could be brewed up by the cooks, by the company cooks, and so on. So, I mean, you didn't actually have any water other than that you carried with you on the march.
No reserve supply then?
No, the reserve supply was not, put it this way, it was not tappable. Namely, you weren't supposed to have it. I mean, you existed on your water bottle. That was it, and that was the rule.
Was it difficult to enforce this sort of water discipline?
No, because it had existed for years, in fact.
So I
mean, the old rule of the British Army in those days were, when you were on the march, you did not drink out of your water bottle after your first 50 minutes march. You could drink at your second 50 minutes halt, and thereafter it was the duty of the officers and the NCOs there to control the amount of water the men drank at each stop.
So the normal practice then was to march 50 minutes and stop for 10.
That's right.
March 50 and stop.
That's right. Later on, one varied it, especially in, we varied it from time to time in the battalion. One sometimes used to do 2 hours, have a 20-minute stop. One found it better that way. But you have to do it when you're on a column of marching, as we were for a long time through Eritrea. A long time we were doing that, because there was just no ruddy transport to transport us up there. And it was virtually at that time working down towards Kerin. You were on a one company front. The leading company were the people who would bump something and try and overcome it. And every time, virtually did do it, and the rest of the battalion were on their feet marching.
Did you have any trouble with feet on these marches?
You always get a few people who have trouble for reasons of the fact that new boots or something like that, or his feet, new tight boots or too dirty socks or something like that. But I wouldn't, no, after a bit you don't get much trouble. I mean, you meet 2 or 3 people in 80 or 100. I mean, you 2 or 3 people in the company. But that's inevitable. There are many blisters.
Anything? What about salt deficiency?
Ah. It's funny, in at that time, in one didn't think in terms of salt tablets or salt deficiency. You just didn't think, I mean, one talked about sunstroke. Not heat, or heat stroke. But one didn't talk about heat exhaustion. I mean, you have a lot of soldiers flogging on with a darn good pith helmet or topi on their heads. Because he thought we're going to get sunstroke in the back of the neck. This was proved to be absolutely nonsensical later on in the Western Desert. It wasn't that at all. It was a fact of lack of fluids and lack of salt that caused it. Not the sun on the back of your neck. And in consequence, later on in the desert, as you know, there are, I mean, most people, though, I mean, they used to have no shirts on when they were not in action and things like that, at the back or digging or something like that, no shirts on, and just a berry or something like that on their heads. That was quite... Or if they didn't have a shirt on. It wasn't the sunstroke at all. It was heat exhaustion, but nobody told us anything about that those days.
So
we weren't aware of it, nor were we aware of the salt business. In fact, the main ration was bully beef, and that had a lot of salt in it.
What sort of uniform were your men wearing then during the
shorts, hose tops, putties, and boots, short putties and boots, khaki shirts, what they call the Angola shirt, shorts, hose tops, putties and boots.
What about headgear? Was it pith helmet? Well,
pith helmet. But they went. We didn't have a pith helmet like the Indian troops did. Or we had that, the Wolsey helmet, which was the British type, which was, it felt like about a pound heavier or more. They're very heavy helmets.
Those soldiers that fell out on the march, were they incapacitated for any length of time?
No. No. In the main, they weren't. One or two were, but in the main, no.
So they were okay to start again by the next morning?
Oh, yes, most of them did. I would say most of them did.
So where did you go from El Gaina once you rejoined the battalion?
Well, then we started our march down towards Kerin. And because we had been down to Mersey Tack Line, all of us, it was our turn to be sort of Arsene Charlie, so to speak.
So you were from
El Gaina, yes. And by the time we arrived at El Gaina, of course, the battalion were on the way down towards Cub Cub. And that was when the next sort of operation took place. There were minor skirmishes with battalions on the way through there. But on down at Cub Cub, and before that actually happened, there was a flying column. The brigade created a flying column with our C company, some carriers, and I think some anti-tank guns, down the road to Kerin. It was a sort of flying column ahead of the rest of the brigade.
So they were a sort of reconnoitering force.
Yep. And they met from time to time, set them out, a little bit of resistance. And eventually they met resistance at Cub Cub.
Was your company actually involved in the fighting at Cub Cub?
No, it was not. Cub Cub was C Company and the Chads. The Chads actually had changed. It was the flying column, so to speak, was Chads and a company of Royal Sussex. The Chads were in the front. They bumped the enemy Cub Cub. And they sort of attacked and didn't get through. They were much greater strength, I believe, than they thought. C Company did a very good, very excellent a left flank right around the back. Cut the road behind Cub Cub. Got a field cashier there with thousands and thousands of lira. The first thing they got, and then went in with the Chads, coordinated attack like that on Cub Cub, and that was it. It was a jolly good, actually, it was a very successful little battle. I wasn't there, so I can't really, I can only give you the basic details of it.
How far ahead of the marching column did the flying column go when it was pushing off.
Stop it.
Did your company have any contact with enemy forces on the way into the area of Keren?
None at all, no. No, we didn't. We eventually finished up on the high ground, on a ridge, on a series of ridges, the town was. We couldn't see Keren itself because there was another ridge to our right, which was occupied, I think, by the another battalion, Indian battalion, which went covered Keren, namely the end of the ridge covered Keren, so we couldn't see Keren itself. But down below us, there was a deep, deep valley. And in this valley, there was a market garden. And when we were trailing forward, we found this out. And it was full of cabbages and things like that, which was tremendous, because we hadn't had... I mean, the rations were perfectly awful at the time we were. And it was super to be able to get a couple of dozen cabbages to put into your... bully stew, whatever it was, for the soldiers. So we sent patrols down.
Was there anybody running the market garden?
Yeah, well, we don't think so. I think it had been really abandoned. There was a white house in the middle there, which the gunners used to love, because they used to register on the white house. And as they, the maps, as I say, it was so absolutely awful there, they could range onto that map thing and work from that to their various...
good surveying point.
Very good indeed. We... my company at the time was overlooking this market garden. And there were also one or two tracks that led up into the company area. And to our surprise one day, the company headquarters was right on top of the ridge. We had a platoon forward on a bump ahead there, and suddenly I was looking at that platoon and saw some soldiers, black Italian soldiers, approaching. And so I, we were on the telephone to them by means of landline, rang up to them, because they were the forward platoon of the whole lot of the company, and said, had they seen these people? Well, they hadn't at the time, because they were in dead ground. And so they said, don't fire, shoot at them. Try and bring them in. And they walked straight into the arms of one of our sections. And they were brought in.
How many of them were
there? There were, I think, six. They just came in. Not a shot was fired. Because we wanted, they thought we might be able to give them some valuable information. I don't think they could. They were just ordinary colonial troops, soldiers. I think one of them was a corporal, or lance corporal equivalent in the Italian army. We got shelled from time to time. We couldn't touch them. It was because they had mountain guns. We didn't. By the time when they were nicely behind, and quite frankly, our 25 pounders is crest clearance.
Just couldn't get to them then. What sort of positions did you manage to construct on the ridge tops?
Digging wasn't too bad. And there was quite a lot of cover. A lot of thorn trees and various other sorts of bits of cover. Not too bad. On the left flank, we had another company right around the left, which was had met opposition. And this was another company that was sort of eventually came under command of Major Phelps as a sort of detachment commander role that he had. And it was on a very, very high ridge. And it took another company just as porterage to keep that company supplied on top of the ridge. They were virtually towards the end on a one-man front. And this is how they were stopped, because the end of the ridge was absolutely razorbacked. And along the razorback, there were Italian positions, and they were face to face. And there was no question of trying to outflank them, because it was a razorback ridge.
Share on either side.
Share on either side.
What about your own position? Were you face to face with any enemy?
No.
You were just holding a line.
That's right. Miles away. Well, when I say miles away, I don't know how far they were away. We couldn't see them. Their positions were awfully well.
Did you send out patrols?
Yes. Forward? Yeah. And it was one of these patrols, I say, got blown up on these mines on the road.
And they went down a track.
They went down a track. Well, they actually went down a road, I think. I think it was the road that went from towards Massar. The road, the Vincely Road, would go lead down to Massar, and it was mined. And they were on a patrol, and they shouldn't really have been on the road. It was crazy to walk down the road. But I think the patrol commander had got most of the patrol off the road, but he'd got two men going down the road, and they were blown up by mines, box mines.
Presumably the minefield wasn't marked.
No, not a thing. They hadn't a face that. I went down there afterwards to see what had happened, actually. And the minefield was no question of anything marked on. It wasn't covered by any fire or anything else like that. No positions covering it. Just a minefield on the road. And a very nasty one. Box mines, about 3 foot long, 2 foot six, 3 foot long, about 6 inches wide, about 6 inches deep. There was a very large element of explosive in it, which had blown up a vehicle or even a tank, had knocked a track off. But it also anti-personnel. Step on it and these chaps went up.
How far ahead of your line did your patrols normally go?
Two or three miles.
And they didn't actually meet any enemy in any positions.
As I say, we were rarely overlooking the valley. We were on a ridge overlooking the valley. And it was quite broad valley there. And as Terence had nobody in down there. In fact, as I say, it was a cultivated valley there. There was a nursery, a garden.
You mentioned the difficulties of supplying the detachment off to your left.
Mm-hmm.
What was your own supply situation like?
Poor. Very bad. Rations were extremely bad. They were very short. And as for naffy stuff, we hadn't seen any for weeks.
No luxuries?
None at all. In fact, with the rations, when you got them there, you got your the cigarettes that came up, the Victory V's or things like that. But I mean, there was one officer there who never smoked anything except a pipe, and he, poor chap, was breaking up his ration of V cigarettes and stuffing them in his pipe because he couldn't get any pipe tobacco because nothing was coming up in Effie. You were living on nothing other than the rations you had, and they were extremely poor.
They're basically bully beef and biscuits.
Bully beef and biscuits, which was reserved mainly for your evening meal. Midday meal, you've got a bit of tin cheese. And the breakfast meal, it was tin bacon and biscuits. Tin bacon and biscuits. Tin cheese and biscuits. Bully beef and biscuits, either in the form of bully beef, out of a tin, or made into a stew.
Who did the actual cooking in your
company? Well, you had a company cook. You had a company cooks, rather. You had about a couple of cooks, or three.
Did you generally have central feeding?
Well, you did when you got in a position like that, yes. You did. I mean, in the desert later on, I was on very much on a vehicle basis quite often. You just, vehicle basis.
What about water?
There wasn't any shortage. there wasn't any shortage of water at all after Merseytaclai time. Merseytaclai was a bit more difficult there because you were at the coast area there, and the water was much more inland on the hill and the hills and the valleys there. But up in the Cairn area, and all the way from Elgena to Cairn, virtually there was no short water shortage at all that I can recall.
What was the climate like up in those mountains?
Pleasant, hot by day. Hot by day, very hot, but very pleasant by night.
So you didn't have any difficulty in sleeping? And
no.
How did the men respond to occupying these static positions after their march? Did they look on it as a welcome relief?
Yes.
Did they get bored with it?
I think they got bored of it towards the end, but I mean, it's difficult to keep them alert, but I think they after the long march they'd had, they really relished the idea of being stationary for a bit, and except for patrolling and having your duties that you had to do, sentry duties and things like that. They were very pleased.
Did they enjoy going on patrols?
That's a difficult question to answer. I don't think one really, any soldier really enjoys terribly going on patrol. It's going into the unknown, you see. You don't know what you're going to meet. You don't know what's going to happen.
What sort of strength were they?
Patrols? The basic one was about... it all depends. It was a reconnaissance patrol, purely reconnaissance patrol. You kept it down to a minimum. And if possible, that was about four men, maximum, including the commander. Four or five, I think. But if you expected trouble, and you might have to fight for information or anything like that, you had to increase it. So you had, really, we used to have, both there and the desert, three types of patrol. The purely reconnaissance patrol, which kept down to the minimum. The reconnaissance patrol might meet opposition and might have to fight either to get information or to get out of it, which is something more, half a dozen. And then you got the pure fighting patrol who went out with the object of fighting to get the information, i.e. you know there's something there, you're going to overcome them and either bring back a prisoner or whatever it is to get the information you want.
And how many would that be, a platoon?
Oh, that could be a platoon, easily. Even more.